Richard Glover is an ABC radio broadcaster and a columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald. He was on this program a few years ago telling me the story of the house that he built with his friend Philip Clark entirely out of mud bricks, which took approximately 547 years to complete. During that program, I didn't really get around to asking Richard all that much about his childhood, but I've only recently discovered that, like any superhero, Richard Glover has an origin story. And his one is a bit special. There is no explosion on Krypton. There is no radioactive spider. But there is a family story that is kind of insane and somewhat distressing and slightly hilarious all at the same time. Richard Glover has always enjoyed the pleasures and absurdities of everyday family life, and now I think I know why. He has a new book. It's a collection of his stories, and it's called George Clooney's Haircut and Other Cries for Help. Richard Glover, welcome back to the program.
I've noticed you've still got the floppy hair yourself, Mr. Feidler.
I do. This is why I was troubled to read about you getting a Clooney. Who told you to get a Clooney?
My wife. The wives always call the line on the floppy hair. We were watching television and George Clooney was being brilliant and marvellous and politically right on and talking about his wine cellar at Lake Como and all of that stuff. And Deborah looked at the set and looked at me and said, look, you've had the floppy hair since you were 19 and the time has come. You need a Clooney. And, you know, one is not sure whether she means the wine cellar or the job as a UN peace envoy or the Hollywood film career, but I think she just meant the haircut.
Do you think as men we settle on something that works for us in our 20s and are very reluctant to change?
We're reluctant. Look, I remember I was in Brisbane actually working for the Queensland Theatre Company. I was 19 or 20 years old and I walked into a suburban hairdresser and said, I want Christopher Isherwood 1920s Oxford, thanks mate. And he looked at me askance. And I said, you know, Brian Ferry. And he said, oh, got it, mate. And so he gave me the floppy, you know, the floppy hair, yeah, the little gear. And that lasted until, I was in my 50s. And Deborah said, look, you've got to get the Clooney. So I sort of, you know, distractedly agreed. And next thing I'm sitting at we've got separate offices. We're both writers. And she sent me an email with no subject line and no message, really just a hyperlink. And when I clicked on the hyperlink, it was a picture of George Clooney with a Clooney, you know, that kind of short grey crop. And so I printed it off dutifully and I made an appointment to go and see our mutual hairdresser, Shane. And I walked into Shane's, Shane Henning's hairdressing salon and I said, Deborah sent me. She says, I need a Clooney. And he said, I know, she's already spoken to me. And then he really did print. See, a lot of people think my stories are made up, but it's really just typing. It really is just typing because he really did. He's got a sense of humour. He stuck this, A4 printout colour picture of George Clooney onto his mirror and started copying it. Much to the hilarity, of course, of everyone in the salon. Much to the hilarity for a while until we all realised that under his talented scissors, it was working. And at the end, people coming past and saying, and I agree, he really does look like Clooney. And I said to Shane at the end, I really do look like Clooney. And he said, well, you only had to ask. So to everyone who's got a good hairdresser, ask.
Having got the Clooney and wearing it home, did it work?
Yes.
Did she like it?
Yeah, she loved it. She loved it, and she set upon me as one would Clooney. So that's the thing, you see, you... it's magical.
You mentioned my hair is actually kind of curly, actually, but it goes through this stage where it gets floppy before it looks curly.
It's Richard. It's Brian Ferry, 1973. That's what you're going for.
Do you think I've been ignoring signals, perhaps from my wife, that I ought to have a less floppy, more Clooney-ish haircut?
She's not been saying it out loud, but she wants me to tell you. In fact, I've just got a text message from her now. Where she merely says, what's this Shane's number?
All right. And having the picture of Clooney in the salon, did that inspire much hilarity amongst other people coming into the salon when they'd see you getting your hair cut up against a printout picture of George Clooney?
Well, it depends whether they were there from the beginning, because if they were there from the beginning, they would have seen the faded roué with the lined, pallid face atopped by the inappropriate haircut being transformed into the clipped, grey-haired fox.
having changed your hairstyle massively, I could talk about hair all day.
You're obsessed.
Does it change your self-image in a way? Because you have this picture of yourself and you can look into the mirror and still keep seeing yourself as you were all those years ago and you're shocked by a photograph.
I think the difference between men and women is that women by these generalizations, of course, but women by and large look at the mirror and their eyes hover around until they find the one point of imperfection. They'll work at it and they can be the most spectacularly beautiful woman on the planet, but the eye will search and search and search and search and search until it finally perhaps finds the puffy ankles or the slight wrinkle on the left of the cheek. A man's eye similarly swivels around the mirror until he finds the one moment of perfection. and we judge ourselves we judge women the same way, by the way. You know, we have a tolerant and embracing eye, and I wish women would understand that. That generosity which we afford to women, we afford certainly to ourselves. And, you know, admittedly, you look in the bathroom mirror and you say, you know, you look at the fade of the brew, and you look at yourself in the eye swivel and you think, not bad. And then it's true that you later go into the bedroom where there's the full-length mirror, and then you look at yourself, perhaps naked, and you say, actually, really not bad.
Under the circumstances, taking it all into account.
That's right.
Well, at least no one said anything lately.
It's a generous eye.
Like I said last time you were on the program, we talked about the Mudbrick House. And by the way, how's that going? What stage is it at now?
Yeah, the Mudbrick House is galloping ahead. There always must be an extra project.
It's not done.
It's never done. The Chinese say when your house is finished, you die. So the house must never be finished. There are always fresh projects. At the moment, my son, he sort of went on to learn all the skills of building from Philip, the man my age, who kind of taught me a bit about masculinity. But he taught my son in turn. And that boy has now become an architecture student, I think because of this experience. And he's now building a third building, which is one of those eccentric architect-type buildings which hasn't got a door. And appears to have no openable windows. What are you going to do about that, Joe? There doesn't seem to be any way to get air into this building. Dad, I'm putting in louvers in the floor. Brackets understood, you idiot.
Why is it taking so long to build this house? Can I ask? Well, it's 30 years now, isn't it?
Yeah, there were no power tools involved and, you know, I had to learn to be a man in order to do it. There were a lot of things to put in place.
I'm very pleased to hear this. Now, there is a story of your childhood that isn't in your book, actually, which has just sort of really come to light. You've only sort of really started talking about it. It all sort of begins with you in Papua New Guinea, with you as a child. Were you born there? Or
I was kind of born there. I was literally born. I was actually born in Sydney, but only in terms of the fact that they didn't have hospitals there. So my mother was pregnant with me and New Guinea came and had me in Sydney, then took me back again. But in a sense, I was conceived in Sydney, and therein lies the story. When I was growing up, my mother always used to say that I was the first artificial insemination baby in Australia. She used to tell me this, but she also used to tell everybody this as if it made both her and me somehow special and glamorous.
Artificial insemination.
Well, she didn't mean IVF and all that sort of thing. That all happened decades later. She just meant old-style artificial insemination, as they would use for cattle. She meant turkey basters and syringes and all that sort of caper. In fact, I've looked it up since on Google, and the dates certainly work out that in America and in Australia in the late 50s, for the first time, they were playing around with the ideas of using artificial insemination for human beings. I think, so that's not bizarre, and in fact it's quite likely. The reason is the bizarre thing.
The reason why she chose to be artificially inseminated.
The reason why she had to have recourse to this technology was that she, and again she would tell me and everybody else when I was growing up this, was that she had never slept with my father. They'd been married 12 years, but she'd never consummated the marriage. And even in 1958, it was hard to get pregnant without having sex. and so she went to Sydney and he provided the sperm so she was, according to her anyway, she was a virgin and pregnant. So surprising they didn't call me Jesus.
Jesus,
really. That's right. And according to my father, I mean, my mother, as we'll discuss, was a little bit of a fantasist, but my father wasn't. And according to my father, the story wasn't actually true, but it nearly was. He said, yes, she would never sleep with me for 12 years. And so we went to Sydney and we experimented with this new method, and it didn't actually work in the end, despite several goes. And so in the end, she had to kind of submit to sleeping with me the once or the twice, and therefore you were born. But so the stories are kind of different but similar. And either way, it's hard to think of myself as a love child, Richard.
No. But I know you probably, no one really wants to delve too closely into their parents' sex lives, but did she ever explain why she remained a virgin so long?
Yes, she did. And it was really the kind of story of her whole life. And again, she would tell me this story a lot when I was growing up, and I never kind of paid attention. You know how these stories just float around in the air, really, and you don't kind of think about them too closely. But she would explain that she came from this very posh English family where, her father worked for Sir Winston Churchill and all that sort of stuff, and she was one of that generation of English kids who were sent away to boarding school when she was 7 years old. How terrible, And it was a terrible experience for her, and she felt kind of not loved properly by her parents. And in escaping that boarding school, at the age of 18 or 17, it was then that she met my father, dashing in a Navy uniform towards the end of the Second World War. And it was in the kind of desire to escape the boarding school and the posh family and all of that that she sort of fell into the arms of this man and ended up being taken off to Australia and then to New Guinea. The marriage didn't work out, and it turned out to be, a terrible thing. And she just blamed all this on her childhood, her parents.
So that kind of made sense in a way, because the emotion, the early childhood, perhaps set her emotionally on a certain course that would perhaps result in such a situation. So you know this, and she said this openly to other people while you were in the room, that my son is the first artificial insemination baby.
Oh, tell everybody! Yeah, tell everybody.
Hmm. And then you moved back to Australia and you settled in Canberra. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You were interested in journalism at quite an early age. When did you have your first stab at journalism, Richard Glover?
I think my first school newspaper was, I think, in year five. So I would have been 10 or 11. And it was called The Prep Post, I think. And it was, probably gestetten. I was going to say photocopy, but I think, it was gestetted probably. And it was, entrepreneurial. This is entrepreneurial. I just made it. I just did it and wrote it up and took it around the school and sold it for a cent a copy. Young Rupert Murdoch, I was.
A cent a copy?
A cent a copy. That's my memory of it. And then the school authorities discovered it. And admittedly, it had some kind of slightly hair-raising stories about school gang culture and things like that. So I was a, tabloid hack, obviously. And they hit the roof. And they... And it strikes me as a strange memory, this, really. And again, this is absolutely a story about, it must have been maybe 1970 or something like that. If you did a school newspaper now, you would get an atlas at school speech day, wouldn't you?
You'd be applauded for your initiative.
You'd be applauded with a name stamp. Mm. But they hit the roof about it and said, you've got no authority to do this. And I had to go round the classrooms. I was only 10. I had to go walk in, knock on the door, walk in. I can still remember the shame of it, actually, and buy back all the copies, give back the cent, and then the principal burnt them in front of me.
What? What?
Burnt them in front of me.
That's fascism.
It is fascism. But then I went to another school. I went to a new school for secondary school, and then I had another newspaper, which had been done with the permission of the school authorities. In fact, I think I used a school gestetner machine this time round, and that was called The Drum. I noticed the ABC has ripped off my title all these years on. But
you were to get a piece of that.
It was called The Drum, and the first story in it, you'll see my tabloid taste, the first story in it was school canteen breaks health regulations. And it was all about, you're supposed to, I think we use tongs when you're picking up the devon or something. So I had to see. And the school authorities were fine about it. But the ladies in the canteen were not. And I do believe that I got cold pies for lunch every day for 6 years as the cost of my actions.
So you're growing up in this household with this unusual loveless marriage between your parents. Did you think that your family life was strange compared to other kids?
I don't know. I think that often happens when you it happens a bit later, doesn't it? I think it often happens when you're about kind of 14 or 15 and you start going to friends' houses and spending lots of time there and you realise, you know, other couples are different and maybe other families operate in different ways. Yeah, I do remember that. I even remember I'll take that back because I have a sharp memory of when I was about 11 going over and watching World Championship wrestling, actually, at some bloke's house. You know,
Mario Milano.
Some friend's house and yeah. Seeing the sort of dad there and the mother there and thinking, okay, I get this. This is kind of a bit different. I think our house got truly odd when I was about 14. Again, this is sort of weird because she was, as I say, she was someone who'd never found her sexuality and she finally found it, but not with my father. And she ran away. This is quite a shocking thing, actually. It still feels shocking to say it out loud. She ran away with my English teacher, who she'd met at parent teacher, which somehow makes it worse. I don't know why that makes it worse. But she'd met him at parent teacher and she, yeah, she, I still, and in term two, you know, my mother disappeared and my English teacher disappeared.
Well, they took off together.
They took off together. And my father was so heartbroken that he left too. He was also heartbroken. He went back to England. And I was left alone in the house for not forever, for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember now. And after that, he moved. A friend of his came and looked after me.
But Steve. You were alone for 2 to 3 weeks. And how old
yeah.
were you?
And then this friend came. And then in the end, my father came back too. I was 14.
You're 14?
And my friends loved it, of course, that house with no adults in it.
And how did you like it? That must have been awful.
Well, I did used to get maudlin about it. I have a tendency to the maudlin, as you probably know. And I'd get maudlin and I'd say, oh, it was so terrible. My mother left and then my father left. And I remember one of my friends years later, looked back on this time and said, yeah, Richard never really left home. Home left him. Which I think was unnecessarily accurate, really.
But once they'd left and the house was empty and it was all, you were all there alone for 3 weeks.
And then Steve, a friend of my father's from New Guinea, moved in and looked after
me. 3 weeks is a long time to leave. So. Was there food in the fridge?
Yeah, sure.
But then that wouldn't last for all that long.
Yeah,
I
can't remember what happened. I probably went to friends' houses and...
Did you get a bit out of control? Did you kind of
No. And I don't mean to make the story sound maudlin. It was a very nice house. It had a pool. I mean, it's not the story of it. You know, it was not so bad. But
I don't know. There's something really primal about that. I mean, you're 14, but there's still something really primal about feelings of abandonment. I think that's powerful.
And look, I think to the extent that the story about my mother. And the kind of lovelessness of it is a powerful story. It's a powerful story because there is this destructive myth we all have, which is that all mothers and all fathers love their children and love them in a good way. I mean, maybe they do all love their children in some sort of way. But we've got this kind of really strong myth that all children have the sort of love they need. And in truth... that's not true. In truth, if you get a group of friends around and say, did you get the love that you... You know, we all deserve this love, this kind of pure, unquestioning, unbridled, expansive love. That's what we all deserve. But if you get a group of your friends and say, did you have that? Did you really have that? Did you have the sort of what we'd all want? I think even most of them would say no. And yet we all kind of believe, and we need to share this, actually. Part of the reason I told the story about my mother is we need to share it all publicly and say, this is the reality of it. And in truth, we all get our love from other places. That's what's exciting about the story. I'm not a cock case. Even though I had this weird beginning of a mother that wouldn't love my father and wouldn't love me, even though she then disappeared from my life when I was 14, even though my father momentarily disappeared, I'm not a cock case because, like all of us, you find ways of making, or like nearly all of us, you find ways of making up for that absent love. And in my case, I think I had someone who looked after me really well in New Guinea, a nanny, Danota. The photo albums of me as a baby are all just full of these photographs of this absolutely gorgeous Papuan woman looking at me with enormous love.
She's beaming at you. Yeah.
As she cuddled me. So I had that love. I partnered up very, very young with Deborah, and she's given me enormous love for 30 years. And you have your friends and you have your passions and you have all... So you build up this store of love. And it's very destructive for us all to say, if you didn't have that love from the, from your parents, A, that's really weird, because it's not, because that expected parental love, there's so many things that come in the way of that, in truth. There's alcohol abuse, there's drug abuse, there's people who have rage inside them, there's people who are for no fault of the fathers who no fault of their own were sacked from a job when they were 25 and they've never got over, have taken out on the, you know, there's gambling. There's a million reasons that get in the way of what is seen by us all as this automatic and inexorable love. And we've got to understand that it's not like that. Most of us don't get it. But, good news, most of us find it elsewhere.
Can you put yourself in a position of a mother who, I mean, so much of parenting relies on being flooded when your child arrives into this world with that sense of love and responsibility, and and it sustains you through all that sleeplessness and hard work. If you don't have that, increasingly you'd be finding yourself play-acting this role to be acceptable in the eyes of other people, because you need to do that. And then increasingly you feel like you're inauthentic, and you have to get out or you're not going to survive.
Look, I don't know if that's right. I think my parents, and again, I think this is a really common thing, were just really self-obsessed. They were just very interested in their own thing. I find it quite hard on radio, actually, when we're talking about kind of ordinary life. Even though I write about ordinary life that I live now, and I think I do live an ordinary life in the family I've created for myself, I can't share stories about Dad barracking for you on the sidelines of the cricket ground, because it didn't happen. I mean, I'm not sort of saying, oh, this was a special thing about me. I think it's incredibly common. We just don't say it out loud.
So when you were in that house alone, what happened?
Yeah, I had one of the great things about Canberra is it was a very kind of intellectual world. It wasn't a kind of world where you'd my world anyway, it wasn't a world where you'd compete over how many schooners you could sink. It was absolutely a world where you would compete over whether you'd been the first at age 14 to read Thus Spake Zarathustra by Nietzsche, even though none of us understood it, obviously. We were pretentious young idiots. And so that would have been the conversation, would have been, I've still got a copy of Thus Spake Zarathustra signed by my friend Toby on the occasion of my 14th birthday. So, you know, awful, but still kind
Behold,
of...
I teach you the Superman, Glover. Yes. What have you done to become him?
I mean, awful, ridiculous prats, of course, but still a kind of great... I'm not interested in classical music, but I still find... I remember, okay, that's Schubert so-and-so, because that was the kind of currency of the time that I'd go around to these other boys' places, and one of them was a classical music nut and would just play all this stuff at you, and another was into history, and another was into... And that was the kind of... milieu on one side, and then that was my little peer group, and then the rest of the group was 1970s Canberra. And, you know, looking back, one of the kind of mysteries I think of the schoolyard in Australia, certainly in the 70s, was the way that 5% of the population managed to convince the other 95% that we were the weird ones.
Yeah, the buffheads are normal.
Yeah, that's right.
When in fact, they're the sporty, good-looking guys who are...
They're 5%. Yeah. You know, you can't... Their mathematics is not good. But you've got to credit their chutzpah for convincing all of the rest of us of that fact. And I think growing up at that time, there was a whole question about what, you know, how would you be an Australian man? What did being an Australian man mean? And I think for me at the time, and I think I overthought this a lot. I don't think it was as bad or as restrictive as I took it to be. But certainly at the time, it seemed to involve attitudes to women, which I didn't have, attitudes to sport, which I still don't, you know, enthusiasm for sport, which I still don't have, attitudes to alcohol, which frankly I'm working on. But, you know, and then you have to, it's no good being, it's no good having great questions about, or great doubt about being a man. You are a man. If you've got dangly bits, you are a man. You've got to find a way of taking pleasure in that and, you know, feeling good about it, not feeling that it's some sort of shameful thing.
So there you were. Eventually your dad did come back after I don't know, a couple of months or something. It was just
and did a good job as a single father.
Do you remember him making a speech or something about how you were going to live together then when he got back from overseas?
No, but I think he did a really good job, you know, to the extent that he could.
Did he cook for you?
He cooked for me. He would make lamb chops and mashed potatoes on Mondays, and on Tuesdays he'd make lamb chop and mashed potatoes. On Wednesdays he'd make lamb chops and mashed potatoes. Thursday and Friday we had lamb chops and mashed potatoes. And Saturday he would have lamb chops and mashed potatoes, and then we'd have a grilled tomato with it.
That explains a lot about you. That explains how you can bring a carton load of baked beans for a whole weekend and think that that's going to be everyone to eat all the time.
Exactly. Hey, look, he was a very, you know, he had a drinking problem and various other things, which, you know, I think if your wife hadn't slept with you for 20 years, you would have a drinking problem. But he had a very expansive, gregarious side. One of my favourite stories about my father is in 1975, they had a big arts festival in Canberra called Australia 75. And I was sort of part of it because I was interested in theatre and things. And there was this this dancing troupe coming down from Arnhem Land of Indigenous dancers. And I went home, all my gormless sort of 16-year-old self and said, good news, Dad, there's these 15 Aboriginal dancers. They need somewhere to stay. Can they stay at our place? And my father's instant response was, of course they can. How fantastic. How fantastic. When are they coming? When are they arriving? I'll put some beer in the fridge. And that was him.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Today my guest is ABC broadcaster, Sydney Morning Herald columnist Richard Glover. His new book, which is a collection of his columns from the Sydney Morning Herald, is called George Clooney's Haircut and Other Cries for Help. And today you're hearing a story that isn't in Richard's book, but it's from his early life. It's about Richard's unusual relationship with his mother. From an early age, his mother would quite happily boast to friends around the family home that Richard was the first baby to be born in Australia from artificial insemination. Not that there were problems with conception, but because the marriage between Richard's mum and dad, she said, was never consummated. Richard's unusual and slightly tense family life broke up when he was 14 years old, when his mum decided to leave the family to take up with Richard's English teacher. So she left your dad and went off to live with your English master, which they met on parent-teacher night.
And I'm still dark, Richard, about people who criticise my grammar on the radio, because I think if my mother hadn't left with my English teacher, I might be better at the subjunctive.
You might not end your sentence with conjunctions, buts, and yeah. What kind of life were they leading once your mum and the master?
Well, he turned out to be into sort of D.H. Lawrence, nudism, and Tolkien in pretty much that order. And they had this kind of fortress relationship in this little house in the bush, and they had a swimming pool, and they would sort of prance around it naked whilst her car, which was named Bilbo Baggins, would nestle in the garage. So it was kind of...
Oh, right, they became sensualists, in other words.
Yes, it was kind of Whimsy meets Health and Efficiency magazine. Mind you, this was the 70s, so there was a lot of this going on. I don't think this was unique to them. And they had a happy time of it, actually. I saw them a little bit. But then when I was 18, I did the thing which a lot of Australians do, and I went up for the big overseas trip. And I got my father to give me all the names of my English relatives, because they're all English. Which he did, of course. And then I rang up my mother and said, look, you know, I'm going to England. Can I have the name of all my relatives? And she kind of repeated the story that I'd heard during childhood. She said, no, darling, no, of course not, because I hold it against them. And I understand that there were that class of people who sent their children to boarding school at age 7, but really I can't forgive them for it. And, you know, again...
Because she said her father had worked for Churchill and was involved in the war effort.
And she understood that class of people did have a weird attitude to their children, but still, she still held it against them. And it was in escaping all of that that she met my father and all the consequent miseries unfolded. So,
and that explained to you why she was somewhat remote or very remote as a mother.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It all seemed to fit together. So that was fine. So I went to England. I visited Auntie Audrey, who was my father's sister, and I met my cousins for the first, it was the first time I'd met relatives. It was fantastic in Bristol. And then my auntie finally said on the third day of my visit, well, you'll be going to see your mother's folks now, will you? And I said, oh, no, Auntie. My mother came from this aristocratic family and they sent her to boarding school and And as I'm saying this, this sort of slight smile is starting to form on my aunt's face. And she says, do you want to see a picture of your mother's family and of her sisters? And my mother had always told me she was an only child. So I thought, oh, sisters. I wonder if they went to the posh school too. And she just, so Auntie Audrey disappears upstairs. I can sort of hear her rooting around in various cupboards and drawers. And then she comes down with this small black and white photograph, which is my mother's parents and my mother's in it and her two sisters. And they are so clearly Northern working class. They're like Northern working class as cast by Monty Python. They virtually have hankies on their hair. I mean, they look fantastic. They look lovely. And I say they look lovely. And my Aunt Audrey said they were lovely. They were fantastic. But your mother was ashamed of them, she says, because they were... I mean, my father wasn't posh either, but my father was maybe one inch above her on the social scale. But my mother's parents were... She grew up in a two-up, two-down, as they call them, in the north of England, in a little small terrace house. She left school at 14. She was a hairdresser's assistant, a hairdresser's apprentice, at the point that she met my father. She was so embarrassed about them and so delighted that she'd managed to marry my father, who, as I say, was about, you know, a millimetre above her on the social scale, that, according to Audrey, she wouldn't let the parents or the family come to the wedding. And here's that kind of detail which is so sort of awful. It's, you know, hard to repeat. But she said they came anyway and stood outside in the rain throwing confetti. So that's the image. And you know, through various means, this is all absolutely true. I've, you know, since discovered by simple things of looking at, you know, a birth certificate and things like that. And I've seen the house where she grew up, and it's not Sir Winston Churchill, and it's not posh. And I mean, the obvious question is, have I ever confronted her about it? And the truthful answer is no, partly because maybe she believed all the stories anyway by the end, but also because I never quite knew what attitude to have to it, because the English class system is a terrible thing, a terrible, pernicious thing. And there's something fantastic and inspiring about this woman who said, this is a poisonous system, I want no part in it, I'm going to go to the other side of the world and make up a story about where I came from, adopt this posh accent and convince everybody that I was from the other end of the class system rather than the end. There's something fantastic about that. On the other hand, you know, maybe it kills something in somebody to turn their back on themselves, in a sense, in that way. And maybe that's... I mean, I thought I had the explanation of why she would never quite love my father and love me in the way you might expect. I thought I had that explanation from the boarding school and all that. But in fact, the real story makes it clearer why all that was so. That it was an act of kind of... It was an act of self-abnegation at the kind of centre of this kind of still quite heroic thing that she'd done. Quite common too. I mean, this is a story in Australian life and probably Canadian life too. I think a lot of the stories I'm telling you today are not as uncommon. I'm telling them to you and they sound bizarre, but they're really quite common, a lot of these things.
People have been coming here from England for 230 years.
And putting on the dog.
and reinventing themselves completely. This is, you know, Magwitch. In Great
right.
Expectations is that story too. You
That's right.
reinvent yourself as someone else entirely. I wonder if part of that process of radical reinvention of yourself in, you know, this other land on the other side of the world does involve the need to destroy who you were. It's not an extension. Mm. It's actually the destruction. You burn down your old self to rebuild yourself.
Well, you've got to, yeah. And you've got to disconnect from, yeah, you've got, yeah, absolutely, you've got to leave that person behind. You're the phoenix, aren't you, rising from the ashes, but you've got to burn that other person first to do it.
Do you think she came to believe it was true?
I guess. I don't know.
Would she volunteer information from this fictional childhood? Like, oh, it was like this when I grew up here. And
yeah, did that. Absolutely.
So she had corroborating detail for this completely fictional life she had.
I remember there was a period where we used to, you know, quite wickedly, really, Deborah and I used to kind of tease her about it. I remember telling some story about India or something like that, and she'd said that her father or something was viceroy in India or some rubbish story. And so teasing her, I said, oh, we think of going on a holiday to India or something. You know, where... Where grandfather was the viceroy. And she said, oh, nothing as posh as that.
Oh.
He was deputy viceroy. But that sounds mean. And I think part of the story I want to tell about her is the kind of, I think it's a story, you know, it's a story about someone making a weird decision, okay, but the weirdness grows out of the British class system. And there's a kind of defiance about it, which I admire.
Did you find her family? Have you ever been in touch with her family?
No.
Why not?
No, I found them on, on genealogical sites, and you know, and I've seen the sisters. I don't know they had issue, as it's called. So maybe there's no family left to find. But it is a weird thing, isn't it? That at age 18, I could have met them all, and I probably never will, because of that.
Were you ever worried that somehow you might? I don't know, grow up. Because we worry we're going to inherit our parents' flaws, don't we? I mean, that's really common. Were you worried when it came for you having a family that somehow you might be a loveless parent or
I think the psychopathology I have is absolutely that of someone who's escaped this, who's escaped that family, and who has created his own family. And my only weird thoughts were always that somehow they would revisit me and wreck what I had. So I used to have very active fantasies when my father would come over and sleep at our place at Christmas time, that he would get drunk and set something on fire and the children would die. And I had that, I had a very strong, and I would lie awake all night. And this sounds mean towards my father, who would never do that, I'm sure. But that was my psychopathology, was not that I would become that person, but they would somehow, that I'd found love elsewhere and built this thing for myself, and that they would somehow conspire to ruin it. I'm not claiming these are healthy thoughts.
No. But yeah. No, of course not.
They were the absolute accurate thoughts I've had about it.
I think this often explains why when I read your column...
it doesn't seem very humorous.
No.
He's a humour writer, ladies
That's
and
right.
gentlemen.
It's really very wry. It's often when I read, cause, which are often about, it's family life. It's about your family life. It's a kind of fun caricature of your family life. I often detect, and I don't think this is me reading backwards into it, an undertone of gratitude and relief about your family life.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I could write about anything. I'm interested in writing, and I'm interested in all the things that writers do, which is capturing these moments. So obviously, I could write about anything. I could write... I could set myself the job of writing crime novels or writing adventure books or writing romances. And I don't. I've spent the last 30 years really trying to write really quite sunny things about ordinary, everyday life and celebrating that. And I don't think it needs Freud to come here to say that it grows out of the feeling that these are special things, that they're kind of worth treasuring and they're worth recording and they're worth... they're worth trying to sort of pin with accuracy on the board like a butterfly. These beautiful things that if you've got a vaguely functional family that you have, and it sometimes strikes me as odd when you walk into the bookshop that half the bookshop is full of the demimonde, you know, the underbelly and the crime stories, and the other half is full of James Packer and Rupert Murdoch and the rich end of town. And there's not so much about the life that most of us live as if it's not worth celebrating. And yet, if you've been from the places that certainly I have, it's certainly... I sometimes wonder, actually, if those people who write the really bleak plays at the Sydney Theatre Company had these idyllic childhoods, which they now want to escape and throw themselves into bleakness. we who had the opposite. Quite like a moment in the sunshine.
After having met your family, as it was in England then, you came back to Australia, you met Deborah Oswald, your partner, and you had two sons. Once you introduced your sons to your mother, because she would visit you occasionally, how was she with your baby boys?
Yeah, she was terrible. You know, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? But she was terrible. And she...
In what way?
She wouldn't touch them, and she really felt that they were germy. I remember one time we went up to see her in her house. She had a very nice house, and we had these two small children, not that small actually, maybe 5 and 10 or something, 5 and 9. And we walked in, and she'd set up this special place for them in the middle of the lounge room. She'd gone and got this sort of bed sheet and placed it in the middle of the lounge room, and then placed this this vinyl puff in the centre of the sheet. And she had both children perched on it so that they couldn't create crumbs or dirt or germs or anything like that. They were in this kind of perched in this island.
On a wipeable surface.
On a wipeable, a washable surface. Yeah. And we were allowed to sit on, Deborah and I were allowed to sit on the couches, but they weren't. And this great moment when we went up, we were staying the night, and she'd put us in a bedroom up the stairs. And after we walked up the stairs, she said to little Joe, she said, don't touch the paintwork on the, you know, on the wall up the stairs, because he'd, as little kids do, put his hand out to steady himself. And she said, because if you touch it, it'll leave a mark. And I'll have to have the whole house repainted. And that will cost me so much money, I'll be too poor. And she
was a hand mark on the wall away from direst poverty.
She'd been kind of weird with that boy earlier, because when we first had the second child, Joe, she came down to Sydney, and we were sitting on the couch with this baby, and she was there, and I said, you know that moment where you sort of try to pretend that you're normal and that your family's normal and that your mother's normal, and so I said, would you like to hold the baby, Mummy? Your mother, I suppose I would have said. Would you like to hold the baby, Mother? And she said, no, I couldn't. And I said, again, sort of trying to be chirpy and cute and things, I said, come on, Mum. I mean, you must have held me. And she said, no, I never did. The natives did it. A reference to New Guinea, of course, and Dinota.
Dinota, your nanny. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Did she never hold you?
Well, I don't know. All I know is all the pictures of me growing up are in the arms of Dinota. And there is a kind of, you know how you can sometimes work things out from family stories where the story's not about this, but that's the implication of it. I got very badly bitten by the family dog, kind of nearly killed when I was, I don't know, 2 years old or something like that. And I still, actually, when I had my head shaved for some reason when I was about 12, you could still see the tooth marks in my skull. And the family story was always that the dog had always been jealous, but Dinota had never put me down. It was the first time she'd ever put me down. I was in her arms all the time. So that was the love that was kind of given to me as this gift from this person I don't really know. I feel in myself now that a feeling of confidence and lovability is in me at the same time as this feeling of anxiousness and self-contempt is in me, and they kind of fight daily. And I'm sure that it's really Dinota and Deborah on one side fighting with these other things on the other.
So your younger son Joe is born, and your mother says she can't hold him.
Because the natives did it.
Because the natives did it, something, and you didn't happen to have any around
in Sydney.
In Sydney in the 1980s Suburban or 90s. Sydney. 5 years later, your son Joe is five. Was she any better at holding him then?
Yeah, well, this is one of my favourite stories about my boy Joe. He's such a fierce little thing. Because my older son is sort of a more forgiving, loving person, but Joe isn't. He'd had enough of sitting on the poof in the middle of the lounge room. And he we were taking the older one to school, and my mother was staying, and we said, can you just look after Joe for 5 minutes? All you got to do is put him in front of the television and give him this Vegemite toast. And she said, that's fine. And then we rushed out to school. And when we came back, I later sort of worked out from talking to him and to her about what happened. So he was there with the Vegemite toast, and she comes in the room and says, you haven't eaten your Vegemite toast. Why? And showing the skill at parenting that has made me the
man you are, man,
she said, come on, Joe, you've got to, using the same affected posh voice. Come on, Joe, you've got to eat the toast, otherwise I'll cry and cry and Daddy will get angry at me. And so Joe nods at this and she leaves the room, and then she comes back 5 minutes later and the plate is empty. And so she says, good boy, Joe, you've eaten the toast. And he says, I haven't eaten it, I've hidden it. And, of course, for a woman with germ obsession, essentially obsessive compulsive disorder, the idea of this germy, buttery bit of toast is somewhere hidden in that lounge room sending up its spores of germs into the air is an entirely distracting thought. And she becomes sort of more and more he won't tell her. And so by the time we get back, she's on her hands and knees, hair astray, distraught, trying to find this toast. And she sort of left our house soon after and went back to Queensland. And, at which point we said, where's the toast, Joe? And he pulls it out from underneath the couch or the stereo or something and flashes me this little smile. And I thought at that point, growing up, I've never been much of a match for my mother, but I've had a part in raising someone who is.
I like the way she said, you know, to your son, if you leave a handprint on the wall, I have to have the house repainted, I'll fall into direst poverty and I'll probably be killed. Secondly, you said, if you don't eat this, your daddy will be angry with me. So, I will be the one to suffer if you do something that's wrong there.
I haven't thought that, but
it's
that's
me
true.
Who will suffer if you don't do as I ask right now.
They're odd families, aren't they?
They are odd things indeed. Given that you and Deborah are both writers of a kind, you write sort of non-fiction of a kind, and she writes fiction.
I think we've established my writing is mere typing. Mere typing, bizarre nature of life.
Does that and given that you often, of course, will mine each other's lives for experiences and anecdotes, does that mean you fight over who gets to write about this thing that happened in the family?
No, I don't think so, because I think you approach it in different ways, don't you? Ideas are great, and then you kind of transform into hopefully there's a kind of process of where there's life, and then when you write about them, you transform them into something a little bit different. There's a kind of alchemy, hopefully, involved in any successful writer. We certainly share ideas a lot, and we certainly help each other with work. She reads all my stuff and laughs uproariously, normally at my spelling. But and then she asks, the great moment in our writing life, I think, is she has, when she's plotting offspring, she has terrible dilemmas often about the storyline and how to make it work. And so she says, will you walk the dog with me and discuss this? And so I agree. And, you know, I get the plastic bags and the lead, and we head off. And she, as we walk down the front steps, she just, this wall of storyline comes tumbling out, and she says, I want Nina to do this, but if she goes to the hospital, then Billy doesn't normally go to the hospital, so that's not going to work out. But maybe if I move them to the father's place, but then again, the father shouldn't know about this until Mick finds out. But then again, Mick at the moment is over there, so I can't use him in the plot line. But if I use this, then I could get one of those other nurses. No, but that won't work. So how about I do? But that's really the wrong feeling for that. And she talks and she talks and she talks, and occasionally I grunt, and occasionally I pick up some dog poo and put it in the bin. And then after about 40 minutes of this cascade of storyline, she talks herself round and round and round until the most perfect offspring plot falls out of her mouth like a gleaming, glistening offspring baby, all perfect and pink and gorgeous. And she turns to me and says, oh, that's it. Thank you so much for your help. And I say, it was nothing. Glad to help.
But of course, the real punchline to that is that you gave the classic father's contribution, which is to be quiet and give a couple of grunts, and that was it.
Baby. And pick up all the dog poo. It's a very important part of the procedure.
Richard Glover, fascinating having you on the program. I feel I know you so much better now, sir. Thank you so much.
And, well, tragically, you probably do.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.